I just hung up a Blink-182 live stream to join this call, so this better be good.
A Blink-182 live stream?
Yeah, Mark was doing some question and answers on Instagram.
Was the main question, what made you want to go on tour with Lil Wayne?
No, it was, where's Tom?
No.
Are you going to bring back Tom? It's really annoying.
Oh, man.
Did you hear that new song of theirs today? The new Blink tune?
No, they put a new one out?
Yeah, sounds pretty Blink.
I don't subscribe any longer to the Blink-182 train.
Yeah, can't say that I ever did, but I listened to it. It's fine.
You really were never into Blink?
I had a phase in high school, which was pretty late, I think, considering when I was in high school. But I got really into...
Which?
Like the first couple records.
First couple being like...
Everything prior to self-titled.
That's interesting.
Or I untitled. Feel like, what is it? Untitled? Is that what it's called?
Man. It depends on which publicist you asked when the album came out. They called it eponymous, right? For a while. Which was like... And then like one time in an interview, Mark was like, yeah, but it's really like untitled.
Okay.
And we're like, okay, it's just the Blink-182 album.
Yeah, whichever one came out in 2003. I wasn't so into that, but... I liked.
You weren't into that one? Oh, man. That's what some would say the beginning of the end, but I said it was the end.
Actually, I mean, if you ask me what my favorite Blink-182 album is, it was the one that came after that. Like,
the
7 years later or whatever? Yeah, Neighborhoods I loved.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. But if you said you got into the earlier albums, like getting into the earlier albums and then also, I guess there's no mutually exclusive in this situation. Like there's
no,
it's not wrong for someone to like all of the albums. But typically if you find someone who liked the earlier albums, they're not Goo Goo Gaga over Neighborhoods. And what was
right.
the second, what was the last, Californication or whatever? Or
I have not heard that one.
I think
they had
the Chili Peppers,
EP and then California was the last one they put out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't, you know, I didn't grow up as a Blink-182 fan, like a lot of my friends who like Blink, so...
But you loved Fall Out Boy.
Yeah, I mean, Fall Out Boy was... They were hitting it just as I was getting into that flavor of music. Like, Blink-182 had already had its day. I got into pop punk in 2004, so it wasn't really so much my jam. I got in, and even with Green Day, I got into Green Day because of American Idiot. I didn't get into them because of their old hits. I got into their new stuff. So I don't know. I think with Blink-182, I came in late enough that I could appreciate some of the older stuff as my taste matured. Cause even when I got into pop punk, Blink-182 was too punk for me, you know, like it was too fast. It wasn't like
something
as...
no one has ever said is Blink-182 was too punk.
Yeah, that's just kind of how I felt though. Like I liked the idea of liking Blink-182 because they had that cred, but they didn't do it for me the way that Fall Out Boy did, because Fall Out Boy had this like soul tinge to it, a more melodic poppy vibe. And I guess I like Neighborhoods because in the years after I kind of discovered Blink-182 for myself, I found Angels and Airwaves, and I really liked Angels and Airwaves. And so I think that's probably the reason for why I liked Neighborhood so much. Cause that was basically Angels and Airwaves record with Mark
and Travis. Don't worry.
And Travis. Yeah, well, of course. But yeah,
I think that album to me, speaking about myself only, as the only person's opinion that's being said right now, I think that album was bad.
Maybe it was. I mean, I haven't listened to it since 2013, probably, but...
I bet it... I mean, if you liked it then, I bet it still holds up. It's not like, you know...
I don't know. I've really softened on pop punk in general. Like, I've had some nostalgic moments recently going through some CDs, but it's not like something I really follow much anymore or listen to when I'm in the mood to listen to music instead of podcasts.
I mean, good or bad, I think it's really funny that because I never thought that Blink-182 had cred. I always thought that in liking Blink-182, I was losing cred. If you liked Fall Out Boy, you had cred. And if you liked Green Day, you had cred. But Blink-182 made you lame, I feel like, to listen to. And I don't, I mean, I, as being, as a listener of Blink-182.
Is it because they, like, they cater to a more douchey crowd?
It depends on your definition, again, of douchey. You
well,
know,
I'm like, thinking of, like, all of the soundtracks that they were a part of, as opposed to ones that Green
Day
were in.
Can't Hardly Wait? What else were they on?
Is there a way to look that up? Compilations featuring
soundtracks, Blink 182. It's gonna be. I'm sure like American Pie was one of them. They had one on there. They had Can't Hardly Wait. Oof. Maybe in their discography section they have some stuff.
I mean, like I'm thinking American Pie era stuff. You know, they were kind of in with like the lit.
Yeah,
crowd.
No, they were. They had a couple stuff like. Some like surf compilations, like some surf videos they had their stuff on. They, yeah, and I think Can't Hardly Wait most of all when I think of Blink-182 soundtracks, but I know that they had a couple others. Yeah, I just, for to me, like Green Day had cred because they, I guess Blink-182, I should start by saying Blink-182 didn't have cred because people called them a boy band with guitars. Like they were like, oh, it's like three pretty dudes. That are just, you know, like playing lame music or whatever, which I, you know, take it or leave it. But whereas like Green Day was like just three weird looking dudes playing at the time. I mean, like the craziest shit they were doing was like Dookie and Nimrod and like, and whatever else came. It was like pre-American Idiot.
Right.
And then Fall Out Boy was cool because they were like underground. They were like coming up and, you know, Grand Theft Auto remix was the big thing to listen to in my group of friends.
That's funny. I never, like when I got into Fall Out Boy, I took a lot of heat for it.
For what reason?
It's just, it wasn't the cool thing to listen to in my town. Like the cool thing, at least with like the people that I was, that were aware of me and I admired, they were into System of a Down and Coheed and Cambria, both of which I got into around the same time, but I caught a lot of heat for listening to Fall Out Boy. They were too soft.
I see. Yeah, like the soft hard thing was pretty lame, I think, to like discriminate about in school.
Yeah, I'm like, I listened to Rammstein too. Do I not get any points for that?
Right, that's what I mean. Like if you were listening to that, like I mean, if you go back even further, like my middle school years, it was like edgy to listen to Limp Bizkit and Kid Rock and stuff now, and obviously that has not aged well, and it's arguably bad.
Yeah,
but like you couldn't say like to be like, oh, you listen to stupid music. Oh, you know what, somebody graffitied on my backpack. Somebody took a whiteout pen in middle school, seventh grade homeroom class. Somebody took a whiteout pen and wrote Matchbox 20 exclamation point on my backpack, and I had to go through like a year or two more of school with just Matchbox 20 in whiteout pen written on my backpack, and I felt embarrassed. And if you gave me that backpack today, I would sort of be embarrassed because there are words on my backpack that were written in whiteout pen, but it wouldn't be because they said Matchbox 20. It could say like anything, spaghetti, and I'd be I'd feel the same way, you know. But like Matchbox 20 does not embarrass me anymore. But for some reason, some dude projected onto me that Matchbox 20 was something that you would be made fun of for. I think I had their album, but I was past it. Like, I had Yourself or Someone Like You.
Oh, you can't get past that album, man.
Well, no, I had at that point, because it was like it was all about Limp Bizkit and Eminem at that point. So you're like, okay, I'm going to put Yourself or Someone Like You on the shelf, and I'm going to start listening to Chocolate Starfish and the Hot Dog Flavored Water instead.
Yeah, I didn't learn what that meant until high school.
I like to think that it means nothing.
Yeah.
I have to tell myself that to feel better about my life.
I think it's kind of punk that you had Matchbox 20 written on your backpack.
See, that's the thing, is that's probably the most punk thing I've ever done in my life. And I thought I was in a punk band for a while, you know? And it turns out having Matchbox 20 in a primarily Limp Bizkit, Kid Rock, middle school homeroom, turns out Matchbox 20 was the most punk thing I could have done. That's like another thing I was talking about. my friends about lately, when the band we grew up in, Sprained Personality, I was talking about to the two other members of that band, and I was remembering this band from our hometown. They started out as the Vicious Bastards, and they're exactly what you think, you know, just like rancid clones, just like punks, you know.
Not a two-piece?
No, is that a three-piece? There's a singer, a guitarist, and a drummer. I don't know that there was a bassist. I think they were all related, like cousins or whatnot. Might have been brothers and cousin. And they were just called the Vicious Bastards. And they were punk as fuck. And they had mohawks and leather and studded denim and all the other things that make you stereotypically punk. And they sang songs that about like going out and killing people, but not like Limp Bizkit sang about like break stuff. They were just singing like very tongue-in-cheek punk about going out and killing things. And this was like a pre-9/11, so actually it might have just been post-9/11. So they were like the pariahs in our town music scene. They would like play, they would try and play like a high school battle of the bands or whatever. And they would either almost get banned or they'd have to change their name from the Vicious Bastards to like the VB or whatever. And that's what they just call themselves. And I remember my dad getting up in arms because he saw them play once and like, you know, just trying to get them, not like making a scene or something, but like talking to like the what do you call them? The coordinators of the show, you know, being like these young men have no place here. They're just going to cause problems. And like, they aggravated the shit out of everybody, but they were punk as fuck. And, and in recollecting the rest of like those memories with my bandmates, we were just like, damn, we were like, they were literally the most punk band ever. And we were fools and posers for thinking that I don't think we ever thought we were above them, but we thought that like, oh, what are these dudes doing? Like, they're just being assholes. Like, yeah, they were being assholes, but they just were so punk. And it makes me cringe to think of how unpunk we were.
I don't think I understood punk until I really spent a bunch of time clicking around on Wikipedia during my college years. You know, who was that one dude who, I think he died.
G.G. Allen?
Yeah. Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, he is a terrible human, right, but also punk as fuck.
Yeah, like I remember finding out about him and then, you know, going down the wormhole of punk and then learning more about the hardcore scene and like all of these different roots of those movements. And that's when I started listening to Black Flag for the first time and that stuff. I got into punk very late, like well past the point where it could have, you know, could have or should have done anything for me, but it's probably for the best.
Yeah, I don't know that I ever got into punk. I listened to Leftover Crack. I don't know if you're familiar with that band, but they are also punk as fuck, as one would say. Yeah, a friend like would give me their mix CD just full of their stuff, or like Fuck World Trade or something was the name of their album.
They've umlaut over their name.
2002. Yeah, Leftover, you know. Huh. It's pronounced.
Where are they from? New Jersey? They're from Manhattan.
I think they're from, yeah, New York City. They're like my friend in high school, my best friend in high school. I won't say his name in case he doesn't want to be identified for this story. He, like 2 weeks before graduation, he ran away from our hometown and went to New York City, and he met members of this band. He like went to find them and kind of crashed with them. They're all about squatting and like, you know, well, squatting. And it was a crazy time for him, and he disappeared, and we were really worried about him for a while, but it turns out he was just living with Leftover Crack for a little bit.
Oh, wild.
I wonder how he would reflect on that now. I'm sure he reflects on it often.
Oh, I'm sure like that has to give him some sort of interesting insight to his current life.
Well, he did a lot of stuff, you know, like when we met up after he came back, he did come back to my hometown he didn't walk in the graduation. He picked up his diploma eventually, I think. But when we saw each other again, he kind of went through his life and what he had done. And I remember him saying like, I think it was the person from Leftover Crack told him that he needed to be homeless for a little while or something like that. And he did it. And he, like, he said he spent a night out in like a bridge or something like that with a box cutter as a defense or something, and had to like fend off other people coming at him. And I would like to talk to him about this again. He lives in back where I'm from in Boston. So if we ever cross paths, I'd like to interview him about that. But that was punk as fuck. So, So Leftover Crack is my only other punk cred, I think. And now it turns out Matchbox 20 is my most punk band that I listen to. So that's punk.
Yeah. I think the most punk person I've ever met was probably Nardwar.
Oh, you met him?
Yeah, dude. It was great. He was so nice.
What was it like?
Oh, well, first of all, he's kind of smelly. He's a little
really?
Smelly. Yeah.
He looks like he would be.
But also, like I mean, I don't know if he's always smelly. I've heard in interviews people call him smelly. When I met him, he was stinky, but I was probably also pretty stinky because it was South by Southwest and it was very hot. And there was very little places that you could go to escape the heat unless you're going to the conference center. Which we were both on our way to when we met up. But yeah, I saw him in the street and he wasn't being accosted by like a ton of people. So I just went over and said, hey, I really appreciated his contributions to the music scene and his interviews and everything. And he was super, super nice. Took a picture and he was really cool.
Was he talkative?
Yeah.
Like what's it like just conversing with him without like him asking questions in that manner that he asks questions in?
Oh man, he's not stiff or robotic. How would you describe him during an interview?
Yeah, I guess this is a good point for listeners to understand who Nardwar is, because I hadn't heard of Nardwar until we started doing Bantha Fodder and you said doo doodle doo doo, and
oh,
I didn't
right,
get it.
Right, yeah.
It just fell so flat in one of our Bantha Fodder episodes, and then I caught on like later on. But that was my introduction to Nardwar. So Nardwar is primarily musicians, or does he do like actors as well?
I think it's primarily music. Yeah.
Okay, so he primarily interviews musicians, and the depth of his interviews is ridiculous. Like he would go back and find Sprain Personality if he was interviewing me about my top 100 hit. Or like my new record that came out that is amazing and that everybody sold millions of copies of. He would go back and find like my first demo tape from Sprain Personality.
Yeah, and but somehow. That wouldn't be the most impressive thing that he found.
Wait, what do you think? Okay, if this is a good question for you and I. I'm going to ask you the same question afterwards. So let's say you are the most famous musician in the world. Mm. What does he find of Jacob Tenders?
Of mine?
That makes you... Sorry?
Of like something of mine?
Yeah, like what does he dig up on you? That's not like, it's not because he doesn't dig up skeletons. He digs up like, oh, you dug up like the action figure I had in my closet. Like you have to go somewhere to get these things.
References to the street where I grew up, or
yeah,
just really weird stuff. I don't know. Like he would probably contact. I don't know how he does it. That's the thing. That's the secret about him. Nobody's really sure. But I think he would probably contact, maybe like. I don't know if he contacts like teachers or family members. It's amazing what he finds. It is crazy,
like,
but it would be something from my early childhood. That would be really strange, I think, but I can't think of what would be interesting enough to bring up.
Yeah. I think he would find like just some, probably like an old cassette tape demo of me singing as a kid or something like that. Like, cause there's just cassette tape demos in my house. My mom and dad's collection of stuff is just like cassettes of me just singing. For no
reason.
It
would be a
like
weird reference from that. It would, yeah, it would be like you would have a song on that demo tape and that demo tape would make some sort of obscure pop culture reference specific to like the time.
Oh, he would ask about Captain Planet.
Yeah.
We covered Captain Planet once. Like it would be something like that. That's my final answer.
He would bring you like a NECA Captain Planet doll, like a 12-inch doll or something.
He would ask me why I got the lyrics to Captain Planet wrong. Or something like he would read me back the lyrics and then tell me how I got them wrong, because I definitely did.
Right.
So, yeah. So Nardwar is an interviewer. He's known
for finding the stuff, and that surprises kinda, you. That freaks you out a little bit.
Your question was like, what is he like in an interview? So physically and verbally, I think he's like kind of waka waka in a way.
Yeah. I mean, he wears like a a plaid golfer's cap, like a English style golfer's cap with matching pants, and then usually some sort of like weird bizarre tee or like a jacket or something.
Just big glasses, right?
No, I don't think he wears glasses, or he might not always wear glasses. But But yeah, he looks like he just woke up and rolled out of bed at Goodwill.
He looks like he lives in Goodwill.
Yeah, he lives in Goodwill, but he has a encyclopedic knowledge of music. In fact, some of the more interesting interviews with him are not the ones where he gets somebody or he annoys somebody. Those ones are fun, but the ones where he goes back and forth with somebody who knows as much about music as he does, those are always great. So his interview with Questlove, for instance, is an amazing interview. That's a really cool one because they just both know so much and they're just going back and forth. But yeah, during his interviews, he's very like stiff. He holds his microphone out, you know, he holds it with like a white knuckle grip right in the person's face. And he's going back and forth between himself and the other person with his one microphone. And he's asking very weird, direct questions that, you know, it's like, I don't even know how to answer this. And he just goes with it. They'll answer. And even if they don't answer the question, he'll just move on to the next question. So anyway, that's Nardwar. You'll get more of him if you like watch his videos. But you were asking what he's like in person, and meeting him in person, he was on his way to somewhere. I didn't want to keep him too long. But he wasn't like stiff. He wasn't, he didn't act like he had anywhere to be. And he didn't act like he did in his videos. He was just very nice. You know, I told him, how much I had learned from watching his videos and how I've used that in my interviews with musicians for my website and stuff. And he was asking me questions. He's like, oh, you know, what's your website? And he's like, oh, I've heard of that. And he was just a very, very nice, cool guy to meet. It was very, I don't usually introduce myself to people in a way that it's like, hey, I'm like a fan. I don't know. I just think it's sort of corny and it's more self-serving than anything else. But for Nardwar, like he did have like an actual impact on the way that I did interviews and the sort of research that I was doing for interviews at that point in time. So yeah, I told him thanks. And he was very gracious. He was very nice.
His smile is the same in every photo.
Yeah.
That freaks me out, but in a good way, in a warm way.
Well, like, I think that's how he's able to live at Goodwill. I think they just think he's a mannequin.
Yeah.
He stands still until they close down for the night.
Yeah. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
I like his Kendrick Lamar interview was one that I watched because when you introduced me to Nardwar, I was really into Kendrick and I just thought it was so funny. Like when he did the doot doodle doot doo and he freezes and then like all of Kendrick's like crew picks up Nardwar and just takes him out of the room while he's still frozen like a mannequin. It's just like the dude's out of control. He interviews a lot of rappers.
Yeah. Yeah, he does. Yeah. It's the thing right now. I mean, there's not like a whole lot of interesting folks in rock. All the cool, weird, interesting people are in hip hop music right now. So it works for him. I mean, he does, he doesn't do exclusively musicians, I guess. I was just thinking of the one that he did with Eric Andre. That one was weird.
Eric Andre is actually a jazz bassist.
Is he?
I'm not making this up and I'm not trying to.
Did you learn that from a Nardwar video?
I think I learned that from like maybe Marc Maron when he was on in the past year or so. Mm. But he did play jazz bass. He went to school for it, I think. So there's a music connection there, but it's like all the best comedians. I feel like the best, like the most mold breaking, producers of comedic material, I think are all have musical backgrounds like South Park, Tim and Eric, Eric Andre, the list goes on. Like there's so many of them that are just so. Like, I mean, I feel like Dimitri Martin, I don't think he's like, I don't know what he's up to. I mean, I saw his last special, I think, but.
Yeah, he's active. He's touring.
He's just like a, he's, for some reason, a musical background just makes people very, like, comedically different, I feel like.
Yeah. I love Dimitri, though. I don't think his last special was his strongest, but the one before that was really good. Can't remember the titles of these anymore, but he's been one of my favorites for a long time.
It's like probably like Dimitri Martin Trying My Best or something like that.
Was that the most recent one?
No, I just made that up. Oh. That's probably not one of his specials
like,
at all.
It sounds like a title.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm saying like if you had to make up a special for like for any comedian, you could probably do it.
Trying My Best. Isn't that the tagline for a character in Detroiters? I started watching that. I don't know if that was on your recommendation or just a spring off of your other recommendation for I Think You Should Leave, which I want to talk about with you if you finished.
But I haven't. I've only watched like one sketch from it. I haven't watched it myself.
Oh, geez. Oh, man. You got to get all over it. I'm on my second watch through.
I guess it is good to watch with somebody else because of the whole like... And it's like watching a YouTube video with somebody after you've already seen it once. Like, it's actually their reaction is what you're looking for at the second time around. So, yeah.
Oh, no, I'm watching it alone by myself again.
All right. Well,
it's really good. That's why it's like they're, I'm not going to say they're better the second time around, but they're not worse. They're very, very good bits. Oh, man. I love this show. I hope it goes forever.
I've only seen the steering wheel one.
That's one of the better ones. That's a good one.
It's funny because I was like, somebody asked me to describe the show when I had mentioned or asked somebody. Someone's like, well, what's it like? And I was like, oh, it's kind of like Tim and Eric based on the one sketch that I saw. And my friend Ben, who had seen the entire series, I think, was just like, that's the most Tim and Eric it gets. Everything else is very different. And I was like, oh, okay. Well,
yeah,
that makes sense.
And Tim's in it. He's in a bit. He's in one of them.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Jesse from Good One, he had a good tweet where he said that like anybody who says that, you know, I Think You Should Leave is like a reason, like a way to point out how bad SNL is or something like that, doesn't understand that like the amount, there's like six or seven, there's like 6 to 10 staffers from SNL that are working on I Think You Should Leave.
Yeah.
So like anybody who says that SNL is bad is like, well, okay, recent, you know, alums from SNL are on the show, so you can go pound sand, buddy.
Alumni, writers, like that. There are so many great SNL spinoff shows that people don't realize are really spinoff shows. And they should, because they're all produced by Lorne Michaels or right. other members of SNL. Like I think You Should Leave has Lorne behind it, and maybe I think Jason Sudeikis is one of the lead producers, and he was in Detroiters too. Detroiters was another one of those SNL spinoff shows.
But did Lorne Michaels produce Broad City?
Oh, I'd bet. It seems like his kind of thing.
I forget. No, Amy Poehler did. And then he also did Documentary Now, right? He's involved in that.
Yeah, he's a producer.
I love Documentary
Now. The great thing about Lorne is like he is very supportive of those that he hires as cast members, because even once they're gone, he stays very involved in their projects. Not in in a way where he has like creative control, but he's good to payroll things that people want to try when they leave SNL.
I think that every person he hires is an investment, and like sometimes it falls like flat for him, mm-hmm. But then other times I don't get Pete Davidson. I feel like there's something there, but I don't get him yet, you know. Like,
yeah,
maybe he's like what, like Farley, and I couldn't say that, like maybe he's Adam Sandler for this generation.
I think he is. I think that's a pretty fair comparison. He's just sort of like the every fair. Dude in a way.
But he's just like such a, like his whole thing is how weird and messed up he is.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think will run out of appeal at some point, but he is like getting more into parts. Like he historically on SNL has not been very good at playing characters, but he's getting better. He's getting more of those parts all the time, and he's improving in that way, I think.
I get worried about him. I feel like I worry about him like a mother would worry about like a kid, like a neighbor or something like that, like a neighbor kid. Like he's just like, based on his Marin interview and like everything you see in the press about him, to me he looks like just his case in general it makes me feel like he's gonna be like the Chris Farley of this generation of SNL, like where he like he's get, like something bad is going to happen to him, and it makes me worried, you know, because like the kid's got talent, but he's also profoundly messed up in a lot of different ways.
Yeah,
and
that's true. But I think the difference is that Chris Farley, like, people might have known that he had a problem, but you know, this was still in kind of the tail end of the era where doing the drugs at the volume that he was, you know, that whole group was doing drugs. All of that just kind of it was just kind of an open secret, and nobody really did anything about it, you know? So with this new guy, it's like, yeah, we know that he has maybe substance abuse issues or, you know, a history of poor mental health, but it does sound like he has a lot of people looking out for him on a pretty continual basis. Like, they're reaching out, they're checking in on him when he hasn't been seen in a couple days or something. Like, people are constantly checking
Twitter
in
is just bothering him all the time.
Yeah.
In many different ways.
Yeah. His Instagram is awesome. Have you seen, he flushed his Instagram and kind of restarted it, and he has this whole collage thing going on. It's kind of cool.
A collage thing.
You know how like people would do the grid thing where they use multiple pictures to create like a bigger collage? Mm-hmm. He's doing that, but he's doing it in a different way.
So I'm looking at it now. Oh, I see. This is really cool, actually.
Yeah. It's not like when I see one individual picture in my feed, I don't look at that and say, oh, I have to click through his profile to see the full thing. Each individual picture works, but when they all get put together, it kind of makes a cool little
thing.
How
does it, if he posts another picture, does he have to redo the entire collage?
No.
Like, I'm looking at it right now and I see how everything kind of blends into the other, but like if he posts tomorrow, all these pictures get shifted down one, so. You know what I mean? No.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it works. I think like every three posts, it looks really good, right? So maybe it's, 7 hours
maybe
ago.
Maybe I caught it on an upswing.
No,
it's perfect right now.
I think people post like three a day.
I see.
Yeah, so every once in a while, like, you'll get stuck with one that's just like bubblegum, and then another one that's maybe just an ashtray or something. But yeah, you post three a day.
Well, it's not even that, because they all bleed into each other, like up to down. Like,
yeah,
that's insane to me. So he'd have to post like nine.
No. It just takes forethought. I'm assuming that, you know, whether he's doing it or he has somebody else doing it. I think he probably has somebody else doing it. He's probably carrying around this Polaroid camera, which most of the pictures are from, and he sends those to whoever, and whoever is doing this for him just has this constantly updating PSD file that has spots for the newest pictures. And then you chop those up into grids and you upload them.
Yeah. I guess you can kind of see where it's kind of like spotting where a loop ends and begins in audio or film. So like you can see where there's possibly like not a trail from another picture from the set above, but it's pretty continuous. This has to be a project leading up to something, or because like this is not sustainable. I can't imagine somebody doing this for that long.
Well, I think
like,
if you're hiring somebody to do it, it's fine. It's a pretty easy job for some person to do. You spend an hour putting together your next couple blocks, and then he sends you a couple Polaroids. You pop them in. There you go.
It's so cohesive. I like it a lot.
Yeah, it works.
It must look better on mobile too, because all the pictures are together. Because here you have like this sort of separation, the white border on the desktop.
Oh right, yeah, they haven't touched their website in a long time.
Yeah. Well, I hope that he does well and continues to do well.
Yeah, he's got some like film projects coming out. I'm kind of eager to see how those pan out. I could see him moving into like a more like writer director sort of role, rather than being in front of the camera. Like he's funny, and I think he'll probably continue to do stand up as long as people stop bothering him. But like he said at SNL, he doesn't know why he was hired, because he's not a particularly good sketch artist. He's not an improv artist, and he said that he's never turned his computer on once in SNL, and you could ask anybody. I think he just goes in and he works with everybody on pitching and developing ideas, and that's kind of his bit.
I think if I had to guess, I mean, like I think I mentioned before, like Lorne sees all these people as investments, yeah. And seeing Pete Davidson, he saw like a new bad boy for SNL, like someone to get SNL. He's like, he's like a hockey enforcer, but it twisted in a different way, you know, where he's not in like a hockey enforcer is just there to just beat up and make sure all the star players are protected and not get into their own fights and whatever, you know, like as outdated as concept as it may be. And Pete Davidson is like the SNL enforcer, making sure that like Pete Davidson of SNL is in the news again today because he and Ariana Grande are dating, the biggest pop star in the world, you know, like,
yeah, I don't know about that though. Like, I don't think that Pete Davidson was hired because Lorne thought he was going to get a lot of news coverage for his personal life.
I think he was hired in order to get that news coverage. I think Lorne saw Pete Davidson and saw dollar signs and his eyes turned to dollar signs in that moment.
I think Lorne probably saw Pete and then thought, wild card. Right. I think every once in a while you need to throw a wild card in there to make things a little crazy. Like, you don't know what you're going to get with him in a bit. There could be a laugh that comes out of nowhere because he fumbles a line or because he breaks, like the lobster diner sketch. He can't keep it together, and that part is funny. Like, it's a really good bit, but I think Pete Davidson's role in SNL, at least so far, has just been he plays these kind of dopey, kind of trashy characters sometimes, but he's also sort of a wild card that can bring new unexpected stuff and remind people watching the show that they're having fun with this too, and that it's not all so serious.
Yeah. It's weird because you have people that are like giving it their all every single time they go out there. Like Kristen Wiig was on last week when she guested on Sandler's episode. I mean, I could point to anybody in the staff and just say, like, this person is always able to pull it off, always able to keep a straight face, staying in character, does a million characters. And Pete's kind of just like he did a little Nicky impression last week, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
That was good. That was a good character, even though it wasn't his character.
Yeah.
I just, like, it's weird how he's just kind of always being himself, I feel like, in these sketches, aside from Little Nicky, although that kind of is him. He is kind of Little Nicky.
Yeah, like the Chad bit, that sort of feels like a very, very dumbed down version of a Pete Davidson analog. You know, he's the one that's like, okay.
Yeah, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Chill. All right, bro.
They had one of those with Adam Sandler this week, but it was cut for time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's on YouTube. You can watch it. It's actually
pretty
good.
I didn't know this,
but Pete Davidson was, his mom took him to audition for one of those 90s Adam Sandler movies. I don't know if it was Big Daddy or what, but one of those blockbuster.
They always hire the twins.
Yeah, that's right. It's easier.
They always go for the twins. Well, you can get the same person without the legal requirements because each kid can only work like 2 hours at a time.
Yeah.
But if you get twins, you can hire them both and you get 4 hours of the same person.
Yeah. You get kids in a lot more shots. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. It's surprising that they didn't hire a twin for Star Wars Episode One.
Oh,
now that I think about it, it would have been more sense to me, like if they'd hired anybody.
Well, but I think Jake Lloyd, he was in one of those Sandler movies.
He was? Oh, Jingle All the Way wasn't a Sandler flick. What was Jake Lloyd in?
Yeah, he was in Jingle All the Way.
But that's not a Sandler flick. That's a Sinbad flick.
Oh, that's right.
With Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Hold on. What movie was it? I thought he was. Was he not? Oh, maybe I'm thinking of Zach and Cody.
Right. That's the twins. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but they kind of look the same.
Yeah, they are blonde with kind of weird eyes, but...
He was in a movie called Madison. Not Happy Madison, but Madison. Oh, man, that's weird. I thought for sure that he was, but I guess I was wrong.
It's the Mandela effect.
Yeah, maybe it was Jingle All the Way that I was thinking. That's funny. And that was Schwarzenegger, man. I guess Sinbad wasn't that too.
He was, yeah. He's the co-star.
Forgot about that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, how were exams for school?
I don't know. I still haven't got my grade back for Java. I didn't feel very great about it. I was going into my math exam, which is the one that I was, you know, most apprehensive about, with a certain expectation of how it was supposed to go. And I don't really want to get into the whole bit, but I had like a little tiff with my professor because they were posting these, you know, this is an online class. So all the announcements that we get are online, and she apparently had hers all, you know, kind of scheduled to go up on certain dates. So she didn't have to post them herself. And these are all recycled posts from semesters past. So despite having changed a bunch of stuff this semester, she had a couple of posts go up that led me to believe that the exam was comprehensive and that I needed a 70% to pass the class, which was not what she told me explicitly last time we had a one-on-one, like tutoring session on Skype or whatever. She had told me that it had changed and that now it was only the last couple chapters and, you only needed a 70% to pass the class, like class wide, not just on the last exam, which was a relief to me. It's like, okay, I don't have to spend the entire semester busting my butt to keep my grade and then have the opportunity to fail the entire class based on the last test. So I was feeling a lot better about it, but then these posts had me thinking that she had gone back on that, or that wasn't actually the case. And anyway, it was just a thing where she had these posts scheduled and she never changed them. So it was still basically the same, but it was semi-comprehensive. So there was some stuff that I had to go back to from the very beginning of the semester that I wasn't expecting to have to study for. And I only had so much time this past weekend to study for it. So I didn't feel great about that one either. I had to split my time between a bunch of exams that were basically within a 2-day period. And math kind of took precedent, which meant that Java didn't. I didn't feel great about Java. I don't think that I'm going to get a very good grade on that, but all my grades in the class were fine, so it should be okay. Math, I left feeling like I bombed it. I left 5 questions basically blank. I studied all weekend for that test, and I know that if I would have just like even glanced at my practice papers, I would have been able to finish a bunch of the questions that I basically left blank. But I couldn't, my mind was blank. I couldn't think of even where to start with those problems. So I wrote down a couple things that I thought were at least like somewhat related in the hopes that I could get a couple of pity points. And when I handed in my test, I asked her if I could talk to her in the hallway, and I brought her out there and I'm like, look, I really don't feel like I did very well in the test. I don't know if it's something that you offer, but if there are any extra credit assignments available, should I have, you know, got less than 50%, which is what I think I needed to pass the class. I felt that bad. I felt like I didn't even get 50%. So, she's like, well, I don't offer extra credit. She asked me what my major was and I told her, and she's like, okay, I take that into account. This is the last tech math class that you have to take for your degree, right? I'm like, yeah. She's like, okay. And so before I even got home, she emailed me and she told me that I got like a 70 something percent on the class, which was better than most. And I feel like that should have made me feel a lot better, and it does, because at least I know the class is over and I don't have to worry about it anymore. But I get really frustrated with classes that, you know, I bust my butt on, and like, I know, I may not know the material perfectly, but I know what I should know to pass a class or pass a test. Not like an A, like, but I know the bare minimum of what I should know to at least get a C and pass the class. And I didn't feel like I exemplified that on my final exam. And yet I got a 70 something. And then when I looked today, when she put in the grade, she bumped it up to like an 80. And that's nice. That's great for my GPA, and that's going to help me in my last couple semesters. But it doesn't feel fair for the amount of time and effort that I actually put into it, because I don't feel like I'm being graded based on what I actually did. I feel like I'm being graded so that I can get through to the next class, which is...
Wait, do you feel like you got graded higher or lower than you deserved?
Higher, much higher. Like, I felt like I got like around 50% of that test correct. Like, if you graded it objectively, I think I would have failed. But she obviously put in some kind of, you know, special sauce to bump me up.
Do you think she graded on the curve? Like, do you think...
I think the grade I see now, the 80-something percent, I think that is based on a curve. And that's fine. Like, if you want to curve your class, that's fine. That's free points. Like, at least I know with the initial grade where I stand. Having, like, where I stand knowing the material. But, you know, I pay for this education. And I'm not going to tell you that I'm the best student in the world, that I spend every waking moment studying, and that I'm really getting the most of my money's worth out of this college experience. Like, I'm not a super studious Harvard student. I am a returning full-time adult student looking to get my bachelor's degree in computer information systems so that I can get a job in the field. Like, I'm not here to make friends, as they say. I'm not here to like learn everything. I'm basically here to get by. But I don't feel that teachers should treat their students that way. Like, I think a lot of teachers probably understand that's why we're here. But having paid for the degree, I don't feel like you should treat me that way, because it's enough of a problem that I treat my education that way. Like, that's my problem. That isn't something that you should take into consideration. So, I don't know. I passed the class. That's fine. But I don't feel great about it, because I don't feel like I really earned it. You know what I mean?
You simultaneously sound like you're very, very, like, grateful that she had mercy on you and didn't fail you. But you also, at the same time, are saying that you wanted her to fail you. So, like...
No. I don't want her to fail me. I want to get the grade that I deserve. And that's why I asked her in the hallway. I'm like, if there are any extra credit assignments that I could do. I was asking for more work that would push me over the bump to get my grade to where it had to be to pass. I'm willing to do that, because at least I'm doing the work. Like, when I do assignments, I may not take, like, going to class. I mean, I go to every single class. I don't miss a class. So I guess I take attendance seriously. But I'm not like raising my hand. I'm not really getting involved in lectures. There are plenty of lectures where I couldn't tell you a single word that the teacher said, because I just space out. I can't, like, focus on HR practices for an hour and 15 minutes. But on assignments, I take my time and I do good work. I don't turn in anything unless I think it deserves an A. I put that kind of work in. And then, you know, in a lot of assignments, I do get A's, but I feel like those things deserve A's. But when I have to turn something in, like a test, where I have a 2-hour limit and I don't have my notes, it's all just off my memory, I feel like I should get the test score that I deserve. Like, in Java, I expect there to be a curve and I expect to pass the class, but I don't expect to get a super great grade on that test. And I didn't expect to get one here. So I'm simultaneously relieved that I don't have to retake this class, and that it's not going to mess up my final two semesters and overload me in what are probably going to be my toughest semesters yet. But at the same time, like, I feel a little bit cheated, because I don't think that I deserve to get an 80% on a class or on a test where I basically left 5 questions blank. 5 questions that are worth at least 5 points each. That's 25% that I didn't even do. That's not including all of the stuff that I'm sure I got wrong, you know? So it's rough. I don't know. It's dumb, and I know I shouldn't battle myself over it, but it is something that bothers me, because I am paying money to be here.
I feel like if I had, like, a degree in education, or if I had thought more about ethics or something, if I had learned more, I'd probably have a better stance on this. But, like, my, you know, layman's perspective on education and teaching is that you need to find a balance between objectivity and subjectivity when you're grading your students. Like, I have a relative who's a public school teacher, and they constantly are getting told to pass kids who are problematic, because they need to get out of, they just need to be out of this, out of their part of the system. So like they need to get the middle schoolers to high school. And even though those kids are doing terribly, it doesn't make sense to fail them and hold them back another year because we need to make them somebody else's problem. So there's that method of grading, which is, you know, ethically dubious and doesn't really help the kid.
Right.
But there's another perspective on that, which a family friend, a different person who I know is a teacher, kind of imparted onto me, where they're just like, yeah, we could hold them back. Ethically, it's the right thing to do. Like, if we want to look at it as like, oh, they need to earn their way to the next grade, but it will only like, in a different eye, like it will only make them worse off. They won't learn anything. They'll resent the educational system for holding them back away from their friends in the next school up. They will be looked at as like a weirdo by the kids that are younger than them. And the chances that they were going to want to try again is going to be super slim. So like, yeah, like you may have skated by, like, let me rephrase that. You didn't skate by. You have been extremely conscientious about your work, I think, through this semester, regardless of the other things that you have going on in your life. You've been, you know, you've talked in social media and like Twitter, on this podcast multiple times about the work that you've put in to your math and like, you know, your difficulty of possibly understanding it, but you're always talking about how you're trying to better yourself. So if you look at your grade as like, what should you get? Like, yeah, sure. You may have gotten like 50% of that testing correct. You know, including the stuff that you left blank, but like, did like the rest of the work over the course of the semester, you know, the effort that you put in, the conscientiousness that you displayed to your teacher, you know, the, like you revealed yourself to be somebody in need, you know, like I, like these classes aren't cheap. Mm-hmm. Your teacher knows that. Your teacher knows that you're just doing this class to get it over with. You're not like going to be crunching numbers for a data analytics firm. I don't know what, like you're not going to be an actuary, I guess. It's like, but like, so to me, it's like you did get the grade you deserve because a less studious person would have done the exact same thing as you and not felt half as bad. So to me, that's why you do deserve the grade. And like, you can disagree with me all you want. Like, it's fine.
Yeah.
I just think any listener who knew you, like personally, or anybody who may have heard like your thoughts on this previous, like, or like your struggles with math, they just know that you're trying your best. Because there are kids that just don't do anything. They don't try their homework and they come in and they get bumped up to the next grade because they just need to be somebody else's problem. Like, you don't need to be somebody else's problem. You need to get onto the next part of your life. Like, you're very cognizant of this too, because you just went through it. That's why I was so surprised when you're like, yeah, so like I just went through the whole thing and like I got the grade I wanted and I was just so relieved, but then I don't deserve it. Like, it's like, yeah, it's like imposter syndrome, but it's not imposter syndrome if you're not trying to be an imposter. You're just trying to like to be in this room and get onto the next room. Like,
yeah,
I think, trying to pretend to be a mathematician here.
You know, I like to be rewarded. I like the gratification and people recognizing my work, but I don't like consolation prizes.
But you are being rewarded for your work. You're not being rewarded for your grade. You're being rewarded for your work. It's like, you can't.
That's fine. But that's like, if you're going to grade somebody on that, put it in the syllabus.
There are plenty of intelligent people, but if you put it in the syllabus, then everybody coasts. Then everybody's a dramaturge learning how to, perform the art of like to perform trying,
yeah,
to mime trying. You
I
know?
Don't
like,
know. I just don't. Like, I don't think that like a certain class, like a grade that you get in a certain class, should come down to the teacher, because maybe this teacher took pity on me and said, okay, obviously he's trying. Obviously he's having a hard time. I'm not going to put him through this again. I'll just put him through. Maybe that's how this teacher feels. But
maybe it is.
I don't think that it's fair. I don't think that that's fair, because there could be another teacher who doesn't think like that. And
it's not fair. You're totally right.
But that's
the thing. You're 100%. It's not. But like, I wouldn't look at it as a should or you shouldn't fail. Cause like the chances of you having the same exact problem next semester it's there.
It's, you know, very, like, there. Oh man, we're standing in the hallway waiting for my Java class or my Java exam to start, and there are these two people there, and they're talking about their discrete mathematics class. And I was like,
Oh yeah, dude, discrete. I didn't even tackle that. That was nuts.
Great. Yeah, that's what they told me too. They're like, I asked them, I'm like, how did it stack up to, you know, say like Tech Math 4? And they're like, oh, it's so much harder. Oh, fantastic. That's great. That's what I want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, discrete, I mean, you could take that whenever. When I was a math minor for a little bit, and I got to calculus 3, and the next step in the math minor was discrete. And I was like, everybody who I knew was in that class was just like, oh my God, I don't understand how to deal with this. Like, it's just all proofs. It's just writing proofs constantly, right, for anything and everything. And it's very important to math. And that's when I decided math is not important to me. Like, basic math is important to me, but I had gotten everything I needed out of calculus 3. And I was like, this stopped being fun. Linear algebra, like a very simple thing, I think, when I think about it. And when I reflect on that class, like, there's no reason I should have struggled with that class, but I did. Like, I would go for extra help with the professor, just to sit down on and have him elaborate. They gave me their time so generously, but I just kind of stared off into space, and I was like, uh-huh. I ended up writing a short story about it. Like, I just wrote a short story instead of understanding this mathematical concept that my linear algebra teacher is trying to explain to me. I went back to my dorm and I wrote a short story about two people being in a room, not having, like, both, one, like, feigning the desire to impart wisdom onto the other person, and the other person, feigning the reception of that wisdom, you know, like, it's like, cause I just yes, I'm like, uh-huh, I get it. Okay, thanks. And I got up and I walked away, and he didn't get me and I didn't get him. And we just went our separate ways. And like, that was my private tutor session. And that's what I thought was
so
most
interesting. Cause I feel
that's
like
what I got out of it.
That's kind of, I feel like I have that experience all the time.
I think a lot of students do.
I just think that anytime I get any sort of wisdom passed down onto me, and this is such an immature perspective, and I have to be in the right mindset to really receive it. But whenever somebody's telling me something, I always feel like, you're just telling me this because it's what you think I need to hear. And that's so dumb, because I'm probably missing out on a lot of good, honest insight, but I always feel like that's the thing. And so I always just kind of play the part. Like, yeah, that's a good point there. I feel like I do that all the time.
Like, how?
Well, I feel like people are always, I don't know, they're always telling me, okay, all the stuff that you just said about how I deserve it because I put in the work, I kind of felt the same way when you're telling me that. And I feel great about it. And it's not like I don't think that you're like coming from an honest place about it, but I just, it's hard for me to hear that and think they're telling me this because they really and truly believe it. Like, is this something that they would tell me if they didn't know me? Or is this something that they're telling me because they know me and I'm going through a hard time with this thing? You know what I mean?
Sort of, not really.
Okay. Well, I don't know. It makes sense in my head. It's tough. I can't explain exactly how I'm feeling. I just don't feel like I fully, fully deserve. Did you just send me this essay or this short story?
I did send you the short story. It's very short.
It is.
But do you feel sort of like, you know, in Serial season 1, when Miss Koenig is like, she's to Adnan, and she's like, I just don't understand, like, because you just seem like such a nice guy, you know? Yeah. Like, and he's like, shut the hell up. I don't want to hear that you think I'm a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I want you to believe me. I just want you to say he couldn't have done it. Like, I don't want you to say,
yes.
And so I was a little bit like taken aback, and I still, I guess, feel a little taken aback that, like, what do you think I don't know about you?
To be honest with you, I feel like I want to shoot myself if I hear someone else say, I don't think you did it because you're a nice guy or not. So I guess kind of, you know, because you wouldn't know that, but I've heard people say that to me over the years, and it just drives me crazy. I would love someone to hear. I would love to hear someone say, I don't think that you did it because I looked at the case and it looks kind of flimsy. I would rather someone say, but no, I think you're a jerk. You're selfish. You're a crazy SOB. You should just stay in there for the rest of your life. Except that I looked at your case and it looks, like a little off. Like something's not right.
So is that how you feel, where you're just like, I don't want you to tell me I deserve this. I just want to deserve this.
Yes. I mean, I'm not in prison. I can't say that I fully understand what he's saying, but I remember that line. Like, I remember that resonating with me very strongly.
Yeah, I think it resonated with a lot of people. It's a very real sentiment, is that you don't want someone's pity, or you don't want someone's benefit of the doubt. You just want you just want their respect, I guess, because that's what separates
respect and real honesty. Don't tell me I honestly believe such and such. I want to really feel that you mean that honestly, because I feel like a lot of times people are just saying the nice thing, and that's totally fine. Like, that's something that we should do as human beings. Even if we don't have our own personal investment or it's hard to get real actionable wisdom from somebody out of nowhere, out of the blue, for somebody to really think about your problem and then come back to you with maybe not a solution, but some thought, putting some thought into it. I always find that I find that more helpful than somebody who just tells me something right off the bat. I have friends who are very intentional, and when they know about something that's going on with me, in the moment, maybe they'll tell me something that is moderately helpful and maybe at the very least can calm me down. It may not strike the nasty thoughts from my mind, but it'll help me think about something maybe from a different point of view, and that'll distract me a little bit from my problem. But when that friend comes back 3 days later and says, I've been thinking about the conversation that we had, and I had a couple more thoughts that I thought that might help you, or that you'd be interested in, that's always the better advice. When somebody who's outside your problem can think about your problem objectively for a while longer, I always find that much more valuable. You can't always get that from somebody in the moment. Maybe if somebody has gone through the same thing that you have, they can, impart something that is meaningful and maybe that you can apply to your own situation. But I think a lot of times it's just feeling like, okay, you're giving me the benefit of the doubt here, and you're placating me is what I feel. And that's not what I want.
I think it just goes hand in hand with imposter syndrome, like what you're describing.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I get it. But I mean, I think in objectively, yeah, maybe you should have failed that test or whatever, that's fine. But in an objective world, there's not all objectivity can really do is make a portion of people really, really sad. I know you can't please everybody, but at my job, I have to make a lot of decisions that affect people and if I went objectively on a lot of things, I would have a lot of upset people at me. Mm. And it would cost them money. It would cost them time. It would cost them brain cells because of the fury that would ensue. And I don't know, yes, objectively, maybe you should have failed, but subjectively, what would the point of that be?
Look,
it's such an old school, not Machiavellian, but just yes, you must be punished because you did not pass the test. I don't know, I'm making him Austrian for some reason, but it doesn't benefit anybody.
I like when there's a reason for something.
To be objective.
Like a obvious reason for whatever it is. If she passed me for a reason, she should tell me. And I know that she won't, because she probably can't. The administration would probably frown on the reason why she passed me on that exam. But that's the thing. I can't accept a nice thing from somebody without tearing it down and questioning it.
Dude, I'm right in that boat with you. Anytime anybody says anything nice about my music, I'm just like, oh, that sucks. I get it. I get it. I fully get it. And you know, I try to counterbalance that, and you may pick up on it. Listeners maybe pick up on it. I know my girlfriend picks up on it. But like, there's this thing that I started trying to do to compensate. And I learned it from Venetia Fair when I was on tour with them. And it's just like this way of just acting like you are really good at what you do. Like whenever, like it's almost like an instinct at this point when someone, like if someone's like, oh man, like that, like good, like, oh, how do you know how to do that? I'm like, cause I rule, you know, like that's honestly, like if I edit something really well, if I like manage to squeeze a sound out or like paste two words together, you know, like I learned it from Steve too, up in Syracuse when we produced records, like he'd be like lining up the drums that we had like for the record or something like that. And he'd be like, oh, God, it's so messed up how good I am. And I'm like, that's funny because there's humor in it because I know you and I know you know you're good, but I know that you're a very modest person when it comes to most things in your life. But like allowing yourself to be indulgent, it's like it's an exercise that I've put myself through recently when I get really good at something to admit that I'm really good at it. Like,
well, don't you find that it's easy to admit that you're good at something while you're doing it? It's much harder when you remove yourself from it, even by a couple hours.
Well, it's hard to admit that I'm good at something when I'm doing bad at it. So I understand where you're coming from with math or whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, like when you figure something out in Logic or, you know, some kind of problem that you're working on and you get it, you feel great. But even when you're doing something you've done 1,000 times, but doing it super well, super efficiently, it's much easier to tell yourself you're a boss at this than a couple hours later when somebody says, hey, I heard that thing you did, that same thing that you were super stoked on earlier. When they say that thing, you're just like, oh yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. That is an interesting phenomenon. I guess if it's, yeah, I mean, I'm never gonna, usually only in the moment is when I'm going to practice this like energy, you know, like where I say, I like pat myself on the back because like, I do feel like those moments should be left in the past. Like, I think the only thing that's important to me, this could be problematic too. The only thing important to my mental health is like how I feel in that moment. Like if I have to reflect on something, like if I reflect on my album, I'm not happy, you know, but in the moment, like when we were recording those songs and he's like, this is a good song. And you know,
you're like, yeah, I know. Right.
I know. Thank you. It's cause I rule. And I'm like, there are times when I fall flat in my face with that. And it peeves Aaron so much when I practice this and it's like, it's half in jest, you know, but it's like, okay, a good example. The other night, I was up in Boston and, eating dinner with Ben and his family, and for dessert that night was like strawberry shortcake. They had the shortcake separately, you know, store-bought, put some strawberries in it, spray some whipped cream, and everybody made their own. And I walked into the room and someone's like, oh my God, Mike, like your strawberry shortcake looks amazing. It looks like perfect. And and like, you know, Aaron's right there and the person saying they liked it was there, that it looked really good. And I'm just like, yeah, I know, it's because I'm literally perfect in every single way. And it's like obviously a joke and obviously just me practicing in that moment to like take a compliment, but ironically it's probably self-defeating. But it's real. And like as soon as I said that, Aaron's like, wow, now I think it sucks. And I was like, okay, well, thanks so much. but that's what it is. That's like, that's it in a nutshell. It's just like taking something in the moment and like making it so exaggerated that there's no way it can be taken seriously anymore. I guess it's probably a defense mechanism
against
admitting
is.
That I'm doing well. Yeah,
but isn't the corrective behavior here to like in those moments when you can recognize that what you're doing is a good thing, that you're doing a good job, isn't it important? And this is, you know, it's easier said than done because I'm obviously not somebody who practices this, but in those moments when you're in it and you're feeling it, shouldn't you just let yourself feel it for a little bit? Shouldn't you reward yourself? Like, you're not gonna feel this way later. Why don't you just sit in it for a couple minutes and really bask in how good you are at this thing? Because you're not gonna remember that later. You're not gonna let yourself feel it later when you're removed from the situation. Just feel it.
That seems nice. That seems like a good, healthy way to process it. So, like, when they compliment my strawberry shortcake, I can just be like, I mean, you can't see me right now, but I'm just like sitting here with a shit eating grin on my face, kind of like looking off into the distance, like, like, thank you. Like in my head, but not saying anything. Like that is the correct, that is the desired behavior.
Right. Saying thanks. That means a lot. Let's, and then enjoy the cake. Just enjoy your damn cake.
Yeah. Well, that's where I'm at with my music now. If someone says they like something, I'm like, oh, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. And they then the person who says that to me knows immediately that I'm bullshitting them and I hate myself or whatever. like they know immediately that that's my regurgitated response. And I didn't get it for the longest time when I would compliment somebody on their set or somebody on their record or whatever. Mm. And when you're complimenting someone, even if you really mean it, it's so hard it's easy to forget what that self-disdain can be like, or that feeling of self-hate, being a self-hating artist or whatever, mm-hmm. You lose it so easily when you're enamored with somebody else's work. And then I would listen to Venetia Fair's first record, The Circus, on repeat, and just have it stuck in my head and just totally head over heels in love with this record. And Venetia Fair think it's the worst sounding thing they've ever heard. They hate it.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
Because objectively it's mixed pretty terribly, but for some reason it resonated with me because they're all my best friends or whatever. And when I would be like, dude, this record is so good, they'd be like, shut up, dude. Like, no, it's not. It sounds terrible. Like, it's just the way of nature. And it sucks that even when you're just trying to take a compliment, you can't, I don't know. I don't think there's probably never going to, there's always going to be a disconnect between the artist and the consumer. Like if I went up to Dave Bazan after a set and was like, oh, great set. Like, he's probably pulling apart a lot of things that went wrong that night still.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, it was a great set. And I don't know. I feel like someone who's very real.
Don't you always
feel
suspicious when an artist says that, I can honestly say that this is the best work that I've ever done, or I really feel proud of the work that I did in this record. Don't you always feel a little suspicious when you hear that?
Yes and no. I mean, unless you felt it yourself. Cause I remember when I decided for the last record, Almost by Old Best Friend. I remember, recording the first track on that album. That was the last track we recorded. And I remember recording it and being like, this is the realest thing I've ever written. And I need it to be the first track in the record, even though it's kind of a slow burn song. I need it to be the first thing because I thought it was the realest thing I've ever written. And I think that anybody, if I wanted anybody to listen to me and know what I was about, they would listen to that song and it would feel honest. And so I could do an interview and be like, yeah, this is I'm really proud. This is some of the best work I've ever done. Maybe if I changed the word, if an artist said this is the most honest work I've ever done, would that be different than them saying this is the best work I've ever done?
Hmm.
If they're specific, I think it's because the best, using superlatives like that, this is the best thing I've ever done is so generic and there's nothing to back it up. If you could speak to why you feel this track is honest, I think that means a lot more than just blindly saying you are the best. Or this is the best thing we've ever done. Because every band thinks their newest record is the best thing they've ever done. No one has sold a record saying this is complete shit. Although I think it would be an interesting marketing tactic.
Yeah.
It's like System of a Down, steal this album. You remember that?
Okay. I remember the title.
Okay.
No, I think you're right. Saying something is honest is a more appealing thing. I don't like feeling suspicious about it, but it's when I hear somebody say that, it's like, okay, I think it is because I understand the artist's struggle with appreciating one's own work and feeling like something is complete and exactly how you want it. I always feel suspicious when somebody says it is. It's like, how'd you figure that out?
Well, it's tough because then it sounds like you're grilling them for something they're just trying to relate to.
You don't ask them that. You're just like, oh yeah, that's great. And you move on. But you think about it. It's like, okay. When Paul McCartney says something like that, it's like, how can, maybe I'm just too invested in your old stuff, but it's like, how can you think that this new record that you've put out is superlative anything? It feels disingenuous and it feels like something that you're just saying to sell copies, but maybe there's something to it and maybe they really have found it, but it's hard for me to believe that.
I think as you grow more distant from your work, cause your work should be an album should be a staple, or just a representative of a time period that you went through. That is what an album is to me. Mm. And so I feel like, you know, the proof is in the pudding for McCartney. You know, he can look back and be like, yeah, I made millions off of this stuff. I am the most famous songwriter in the world because of, you know, the first Beatles albums or whatever. But this record right now, I feel so much more connected to than I did singing Help or whatever, you know, like, or singing ditties with John. Like, this new record I'm putting out, it encapsulates my mindset as like a 70-something-year-old man. You know, and I think the farther you get from that time period, it's like how, you know, if you asked me in seventh grade what my favorite band was and what the best music in the world was, I'd be like, Limp Bizkit rules, dude. but like, as you know, 20 years removed from that, I'm like, Limp Bizkit sucks, man. And like, that's just what I think is like, that's why I don't think it's disingenuous, you know, for someone to say that, because I honestly believe in that moment. I mean, sure, there are people that are just trying to cover their asses. Maybe like their label just is making them put out this record. But I've definitely seen bands that are like, don't buy this record. Mm. Like, it's like, this is shit, and I just put it out. I mean, didn't Frank Ocean do that? I don't think Frank Ocean would say his album is shit, but like, didn't Frank Ocean put out like an album that didn't do as well on like Apple Music or something like that, and then went and made like a lot on another album?
No, that's a no.
What happened? Didn't he put something out to get off contract? Yeah, with one
he put out
label.
He put out a visual album called Endless.
Yes,
and I don't think it was throwaways, because honestly,
no, definitely not.
Endless is maybe my favorite Frank Ocean record. It does feel like it's bits and pieces. It doesn't feel like a totally completed thing, but it's stuff that I think a majority of it was made after the record that he released a couple days after that, because that was the record that he made and he was gonna release on Def Jam, but he didn't want Def Jam to have it, so he released Endless just to get off. And he ended up, I think, buying Endless back. I think he owns everything now, but I don't think he was unhappy with any of it. I don't think he's put out anything he's unhappy with. I don't think he has the capability of actually doing that.
Well, yeah. At the time, the way I read that situation was like, this is just like a not a throwaway, but just like a last ditch effort to get my way or something.
It's interesting you say it that way. A lot of the hip hop community calls it a finesse.
Well, I mean, not knowing anything about Frank Ocean besides what I've heard and dissect.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
You're the Frank Ocean expert for sure. So I know very little. yeah, man. Yeah, but I can see where the desire to say what you're doing is the best thing you've ever done.
Yeah. I think like that's what I want. Like, I want to create something where I can say, this is the best thing I've ever done. And I think the project that I've been historically most proud of has been Bantha Fodder, but most of that's you're doing. Like, I'm proud of it, but a lot of the stuff that I'm proud of is your editing work and the cool stuff that we're able to do with it as a result of your savvy. But, yeah, it's just like, it feels like there's a secret out there that I'm either not getting, or that somebody's pretending to have unlocked.
A secret to what?
To
being proud of your own work?
Yeah, to being like actually genuinely proud of something that you put out, not something that you've just finished. Not in the way where, you know, like Tyler, the Creator, records a record over the course of a couple of weeks or something and then drops it and is super happy with it. But in a way that Tyler, the Creator, can look back at a record he put out 3 years ago and be like, yeah, that was a really special thing that really came together in this way that I'll really be proud of I'm proud of now and will be proud of for a long time. Cause he's not selling anything at that point. The sales they're just going to trickle in from now on, maybe not at his scale, but you know, it's not going to be the push that it originally was. So when you say something so superlative about something when it just comes out, it's like, ah, all right, well, I'm going to check back in with you in a couple of years. I'm going to ask you to rank your records and then we'll see where it stands. You know what I mean?
I mean, I'll have to put it like another record if I'm going to make this anything interesting.
I don't mean you specifically. I think Blink recently did this. I think they did an album ranking, and Bayside has done it in the past, and that's been kind of interesting. I might have asked Bayside to do that, actually. I can't remember if that was from one of my interviews or somebody else, but
Let's do a Blink-182 album ranking.
Neighborhoods.
I don't know how many we're looking at right now, but how many numbers?
How many? How many? Like a number of albums?
Yeah, they've done like. I don't know.
One,
like, I just
two,
think
three,
that
four, five, six, seven.
It just depends on what you think of as their best album. Like, I think front to back album, cohesive album, the self-titled album was like, it was like, it had a huge impact on my life as a musician. And I think front to back, it's just like the most easily listenable one. Like, every other album I'll come back, I'll pick and choose. There's like, there's really no, I wouldn't say there's any filler songs in any Blink-182 albums. Like, maybe on some of the earlier ones, like Cheshire Cat and Buddha or whatever, but like every album is all pretty strong, but I just don't need, like, I wouldn't want to listen to Roller Coaster by Blink-182 off Take Off Your Pants and Jacket, you know, on its, like, I don't go to that song unless I'm looking for a very specific mood, which is almost never. But still, like, every single song on that album is super catchy and is almost not a joke song. Like,
right.
Like,
yeah.
Happy Holidays, You Bastard is like not something like, I'm not like, oh man, let's really put on Happy Holidays, You Bastard. Really.
I don't know. I think for me, it would probably go Neighborhoods, and then you could put in any order, California, self-titled, Take Off Your Pants and Jacket, Enema of the State, and then you could go reverse chronologically for the rest. And that would be my ranking.
Yeah. I get it. I just don't, the Neighborhoods and California, those are just like Skiba, like in general, like, ugh, just such a blah, blah, blah voice.
What? Oh, you don't like Alk Trio?
No, I'm not an Alkaline Trio fan. I'm sorry.
There was a point in time where I think I could have really, really gotten into them. But I got into Bayside instead.
It's like the road not taken.
Yeah. The road not taken. And then I might have if I had taken that route, I might have become a Blink fan once he joined the band. It's weird. I have no like attachment to Blink at all. But with Skiba, maybe that would have been my inroad.
Oh my God. I had a friend who was super into Blink and super into Alkaline Trio. And I remember the day Skiba joined the band. I was like, this dude is wicked happy right now. This made this dude's year. Maybe his decade.
Yeah.
Man.
So yeah, I'm on break now.
You're on break? Oh great.
I guess.
We need to give you some work to do.
Oh please don't. I have enough going on. Plenty of work, and I don't know. I'm trying to figure out what I'm gonna do to relax. Like what activity I'm gonna take up to chill out for a couple weeks before I start my new job.
Any good games you've been meaning to play?
I take it you're segueing into the next bullet point that I had in the follow-up section of our document.
That's actually an honest question. I was going to suggest a game to play.
Oh, really?
But now that you mention it.
No, I want to hear your suggestion, because I was going to ask if
there's a game that you had your eye on.
I wanted to start playing Portal, because I got it in like a Steam sale, or maybe it's free. I don't know. I got it on Steam a while back, and I decided the other night that I was going to download it and try to play it, because I've always heard good things about the game and the personality that the little robot has, and there's the Jonathan Colton song in at least the second one. It seems like something that I would really enjoy. I like puzzles and that kind of stuff. And I tried playing it, and it wouldn't launch. I installed it, and it wouldn't launch, so I reinstalled it, and it wouldn't launch, and I didn't think anything of it. I was like, fine, whatever. I read a couple forums and they said that there's just problems on the Mac with it. They haven't updated it or patched it. Like, okay, fine. And then the other day,
is it a Mojave thing?
It was like a High Sierra thing. They haven't patched it since then. Or maybe Sierra, I don't know. It's been a while. But then the other day I'm like, okay, I'll try it one more time. And I think maybe just restarting Steam might have done it, because it started up and it played, and I adjusted my screen settings to a better resolution for a 4K iMac or 5K iMac, and it worked, and I played for about 15 minutes, made it through, I don't know, probably as many stages, and then I got really sick. I got motion
from
sick.
From what?
Motion sick from the game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't play it. I even took it out of, like, full window. I put it into windowed mode. It was in full screen. I took it into windowed, and that didn't help, and I just can't do it.
Oh, yeah, you get you get vertigo from like the portals, like sending yourself in and out of them?
It wasn't even so much that stuff. It's the turning around and the lack of, like, newer games I'm able to play better because they have better shading and they seem more realistic. There's just something about the lower poly era that really gets me like super nauseous when I play it. I don't know. It's the same. It's the feeling that I would get if I got car sick or, you know, motion sick of some kind. It's just a really uneasy, gross feeling. Mm. So I'm not going to play that, but I'm willing to hear suggestions.
I don't have any right now. I'm still Zelda-ing out. So any free moment I have is spent with Zelda.
Yeah. How's your progress?
Seldom. I just got my third Divine Beast.
Okay.
And that's it.
Well, let me ask you about the Divine Beast then. So the first time that you played against the Divine Beast, what was your thought?
Against a Divine Beast? Like in the temple?
The Divine Beast. Like there's like a bunch of challenges and then you have to like... Don't you have to kind of like battle them after you figure out all the puzzles and reactivate it?
Well, the game, like the formula is you go to this region, you have to go through some challenge to get to the Divine Beast. You have to collaborate with some character in that region to board the Divine Beast.
Yes. Yeah.
And once you are on the Divine Beast, you must access the controls and then you must fight a Ganon-esque character inside of
That's what I meant.
And then the Divine Beast joins your cause.
Okay, so
that's the formula.
You're trying to free the Divine Beast from this Ganon-esque spirit. So the battles against the Ganon minis, that's what I'm interested in. The first one that you played against, did you think it was difficult?
The first one I thought was regular.
Okay.
Difficulty. The second one I fought with, I felt like I was cheating because I used the arrows,
the bomb
like
arrows?
The no, not the bomb arrows. Oh, okay. The what do you call them? The
stunning arrows, like the time arrows, or
no? It's like the really hard to find arrows, like the expensive ones that you have to make, like the guardian arrows or whatever
yes,
they're called.
Yeah, guardian arrows.
Yeah, I like used two of those, and then like some big ass like guardian axe plus, and I killed the thing in like one or two tries tops. Like it wasn't more than two tries. Like Aaron's like, oh my god, you beat him already. Then the third one I had to spend a lot more time on, but once you learn their patterns, it's all easy.
Yeah, okay.
It's just the degree of difficulty that I look for in Zelda. Like Majora's Mask for N64 on the N64, not for the 3DS, very difficult and very frustrating to play. But when it comes to this game, it's very gratifying to figure out the boss, and like the parry system is really interesting and really fun because, you know, it's really hard to get it. Like you can get into a pattern and like think that you know how to parry and then just make one little mess up and then just get blasted to death by some stupid beam cannon.
Right. Yeah. It does have a sort of formula after the second or third one, I felt. And
yeah,
by the time I got to the last one, I'm like, oh man, okay, these got pretty easy. But that was one of the few moments.
Also powering up.
Yeah, like, that's true.
Like the amount of like I have like 7 hearts and I'm 3 Divine Beasts in. I've dumped and I have 3 full rings of stamina at this point.
Oh yeah, attaboy.
Yeah, like I dumped every single thing, every shrine I dumped into my stamina. So like I can just run around forever, I can climb forever. It's almost unfair. But it's the best way to play the game because like it's not getting frustrated at like falling off a cliff when I'm trying to climb up somewhere. It's like it's not getting fatigue when I'm running around from a boss or whatever. It's just I think it's the superior way to play.
How's your shrine status? Where are you at completion wise?
I mean, I probably have like 50 shrines down under my belt at this point, maybe. That's cool. How many are there? 100?
That is a good question because I don't know if did they add any with the
I don't have the DLC, if there is any.
Let's see. Shrines count. Shrines. Oh no, I'm on IGN.com. How did that happen? There's 120 total.
Okay. Yeah, so I have a ways to go.
It's pretty progress.
I get anxiety playing that game because I feel like I'm not going to be able to get it all.
You definitely
like I'm
can.
Not, like I'm, well, but like there's some things I don't want. Like I know that getting all the Koroks doesn't matter because there's only so many you can, like it doesn't matter after like 100 or something like that.
Yeah.
And there's like how many, 300 Koroks?
And those are rather like, challenging, I find.
Some of them are just like pick up a rock on this mountain, but yeah. Other ones like going to find them all, like seeking them out. Yeah that's difficult.
It's hard. Yeah.
That's, but actually obtaining them.
That's what I was doing when I kind of stopped playing.
Yeah, I can see burnout in that. The thing I do like about the game is that you can just pick a direction and head in it, mm-hmm. and you will undoubtedly find something to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like,
and, like, your quest list is endless. Like, I'm racking up all these side quests and not making any progress on them, and that gives me anxiety because it's like, well, I don't know where this place is. I don't even know what they're talking about. Go find some scale or something? Like, what are they even meant?
Have you been to that
it's
mountain?
Like how you feel. That mountain?
That mountain. I'm trying to remember which one it was. Maybe it's the Satori Mountain. It has like a lake on the very top of it. I think it's Satori Mountain.
The lake in the shape of like a heart or something? Or
maybe. The lake itself isn't as significant, but the thing that appears there is.
I'm looking at the map because I'm trying not to spoil whatever you're talking about. And
well, I'm not trying to like not spoil it for people listening to the show. I'm trying to not spoil it for you because it was one of the cooler bits of the game for me.
Yeah, I don't know. No? I can't look at it now.
Okay. Well, there's a cool thing that appears on a mountain, and when you find it, let me know. Just I thought it was like a kind of cool thing.
Yeah, I'll look for it.
There's always something Yoshi. To surprise you. It's not a Yoshi. I'm just going to tell
a
you that
big
right now.
Yoshi.
It's not any size Yoshi.
No. But a little Yoshi?
No, not even a little Yoshi. But, yeah. Man, one of these days we're going to have to talk about Endgame.
I don't know if we are, because I don't want to talk spoilers.
It's we're allowed to now. The Russo brothers said it's okay.
It's a fuck the Russo brothers.
Man, I'll tell you what. They said, okay, you could talk about spoilers now. And man, I saw it all on my feed that day. Everything.
Who was actually listening to them? Who are the people that were listening?
I don't know. It's so funny that they said that, though, because they said that the same day that they put out that teaser trailer for Spider-Man.
Far From Home. Yeah, which I haven't watched and I'm not going to watch. And all I know is that in the teaser trailer, he's like recounting Tony Stark being dead.
Oh, well, you just gave it away. At the very beginning of the trailer.
Oh, are we still recording?
At the very beginning of the trailer, he comes on. He's like, look, don't watch this trailer if you haven't watched Endgame. Seriously, don't watch this trailer if you haven't seen that movie yet. That was in the trailer. It's so weird. It was the same day that they're like, yeah, you can talk about spoilers now.
What a fucked up release. Of like what is the movie industry nowadays? You know, like
I don't know or care anymore.
When have, like, if you look at the MCU and the rate that these movies are coming out, you're getting a movie is getting a sequel like a month later. Like Endgame, you could argue, is the sequel to Captain Marvel, and Far From Home is the sequel to Endgame by the fact that these
timeline.
Movies are. Well, the timeline, but also because the pure act of advertising these movies is spoiling another one, and the movie has only been out for less than a month. Like that's insane to me.
I'm just
that,
like
you could.
I'm just really fed up with everything, as it pertains to viewable media. I don't care anymore. Like I'm really enjoying the celebration of I Think You Should Leave. The internet loves it, and I love it too, and I love that we can all love it together. I absolutely cannot stand the conversation surrounding Game of Thrones. It's not fun anymore. Like the big battle episode was fun to talk about it up to that point because we are all taking our bets. Like who's gonna die?
The death pools.
Right. That's all interesting. But then after the last episode, people are just like, oh, well, the writers are just phoning it in, trying to move on to the next project. Oh, there's a coffee cup. I do not give a shit. Shut the fuck up. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Just watch the damn show. It's entertaining.
Good.
Like, regardless of what happens, like, nobody is going to be, there isn't going to be a 100% happy rate. There just isn't. Breaking Bad was a phenomenal show. There are still people who are pissed off about the ending. I don't care. I don't care anymore. It doesn't bother me. Marvel, it doesn't bother me. Avatar, stop shitting on it if you don't care. I care, and that's fine. I want to talk about that movie with people that still care about Avatar. I want to be excited for the five movies that are coming out in this strange foreign land that takes forever to generate with computers. I don't care about your opinions about it at all.
you're one of those more highly evolved like film or television watchers, like, who's just like happy to exist, you know, like, yeah. you're not dwelling on bad content. You're just being like, let's keep pushing forward, you guys. We're getting this one out of the way. Come on.
It's just like, you know, shows get canceled so quickly these days because studios want to make money. They want a show that people are excited about watching. And then when people are shitting on the show that you like, and they're spreading this discontent about a show that a bunch of other people probably haven't even seen, they're making it less likely for those people to want to watch this show. In a lot of cases, this is probably not true for everything. You know, the whole, like, any press is good press kind of argument, I'm sure, exists for some shows. But there are definitely shows that are on for a couple seasons, and people who initially like the show get angry at the direction that it goes. They start complaining about it on Twitter, which dissuades all of their friends from watching it. And then they cancel the show. In the meantime, there's a lot of us who are really into that show. And now it's gone. And yeah. It's your fault. God damn it.
Patriot. It's not my fault. I like Patriot.
Well, no, I don't think Patriot's a good example because not enough people know about that show. That's the problem. People are watching that show and talking shit about that show. People are watching and they're talking like they're saying the show's amazing, but not enough people are watching the show.
What is a show that you're referring to then that people are shitting on that got canceled for people talking about it? Because I don't think that's a show that exists.
Oh, dude, I don't know. Like, I think Busy Phillips is probably an example of that. It's not a show that I watch, but it did get canceled. And there were people who genuinely loved that show. But it got canceled because, you know, what discussion there was online was generally negative. People weren't, like, super into Busy Phillips. And that's fine. I get that. I'm not, like, a big fan of her either. But I'm not going to shit talk a show that I don't even watch just to ruin it for the people that do.
Well, that's stupid. That's like the people that shit on Amy Schumer or whatever, just for the fact that she is Amy Schumer or whatever. Like, I don't know shit about Amy Schumer. I don't watch her show. I'm not going to talk about it. But there are people that just know Amy Schumer and they're just like, they're just going to shit on whatever she does.
Like, I'll shit on Amy Schumer and everything she does, but I have reasons.
She'd probably like that.
Oh, God. She's a mother. You'd be nice.
Oh, as of like yesterday.
Did she ever kid?
She did, yeah.
Oh, cool. That's nice. Well, that's good. No, she steals jokes. That's dumb. But apart from that, I don't know. Like, I think it'd be fun to talk about Avengers Endgame just because you are a Marvel fan and you're very into this world. And I don't think you were included on the Welcome to Geekdom Roundtable.
Yeah, Deanna, I'm so mad about that.
I'm not
mad about that. Don't worry.
I'm excited to listen to that because my friend John Lally was on that episode. I've never heard him on a podcast before. I didn't even know that he and Deanna knew each other, so I'm gonna check that out. But
I just get very stressed out by a lot of people talking at once, like you and me. That's as much as I can handle.
Yeah. But no, you're a fan of the series, and I'm interested to actually hear your full thoughts on the thing. And I'm not like a super big fan of the series. I'm not like anti Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I was surprised at how I felt when I walked out of that theater. I think that could be worth talking about, but maybe sometime.
We don't have to rush about it.
Maybe when it comes out.
We'll give like spoiler alert plus whenever, however long. I mean, I could talk about it right now for however long. Like, you give me 10 minutes, I'll talk about Avengers Endgame for 10 minutes.
I'm going to move that into our big topic section because I think if we do talk about it, it will take a while. And we're not
because we're going to end up talking about the entire MCU.
Yeah, probably. I think you have to, right? With the way that movie kind of played out. I think
it's, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, you're summing up the entire universe. God, I just wish it was over, you know, like,
yeah,
keep Tom Holland doing his own little thing, that's fine, but just no more movies, please.
Did you see the Disney schedule?
No, I did not.
Well, Disney put out a schedule of all the movies that they're going to be putting out in the next like 10 years.
Oh, and Jesus.
It includes all the Marvel, all the Avatar, all the Star Wars. It's pretty crazy.
I'm not going to look at that.
There's not like
I'm
a ton.
I'm just not
going
to look at it.
For Marvel, though. That's the good thing. That was one of my takeaways.
I mean, I saw the ones like Shang-Chi, Doctor Strange, Black Panther 2, you know, like the ones that we knew were coming that made Endgame less interesting.
Well, they removed 3 from the schedule, which is interesting.
Ooh, which
3? Well, untitled Fox Marvel films. They canceled like all the Fox ones. So what does that mean?
That's X-Men. X-Men and Fantastic Four.
So they're just done with those? Or are they going to reboot them?
I would like it. Maybe they canceled them only to give birth to them again.
Mm.
Maybe they canceled them to restart them.
Mm-hmm.
That whatever little development was going into the Fantastic Four pictures, they were like, well, let's just reboot it. Because, I mean, after Endgame, where else are you going to go? Galactus is like, what's going to top? Because it was always funny to me that. Not to get into Endgame too much, but like the climax of Endgame, I'm not going to say what it is, but I will say that the area that it takes place in is a relatively, you know, small area of planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it probably takes place, generously speaking, over the course of like 5 square miles, generously, you know, like, so like, that's not that much space, considering that all of these threats span across galaxies. So, like, how are you going to up the ante in the MCU? The answer, I think, is Galactus.
You're probably
right. That's all. That's all I'm saying.
If they ramp it up that high again. I wonder if this is, like, the peak, and the rest is just fun individual films like Spidey.
Well, Guardians 3 is going to be, like, well, whatever. But, like, I mean, they teased Adam Warlock in Guardians 2, so I feel like that opens up the cosmic realm even more. Like, Guardians was, like, the gateway to just the Marvel cosmic universe, and then, like, Adam Warlock will be, like, the foyer, if you will, like, he's just gonna bring it to the next level. And soon we'll have like Eternity and Chains, you know, all that good stuff. That's going
to
be great.
You're getting into so much that I know zero about. Adam Warlock, I just had to Google this. Yeah. I have no clue.
I didn't either until Guardians 2.
Oh, man. Was he in Guardians 2?
He was the stinger scene.
Oh, I guess I don't remember that.
Hmm.
It didn't click and I thought it was something else. Who knows? Oh, man. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was very unremarkable. It's just like, we call this golden egg Adam. And then you're just like, okay. And then like two guys in the movie theater are like, yeah. And you're like, why are they yelling? Yeah. And they're just like, and then they tell you.
You know what? With the MCU kind of wrapping, maybe not wrapping up, but winding down a little bit, I think this just makes me more excited for Avatar. We're getting back into another cinematic universe.
You just want like another intellectual property expanding
to look forward to. Yeah, something that, you know, like something that I can look forward to as sort of a traditional thing. We're gonna have a little bit of a gap for Star Wars, which is totally fine. But I saw Avatar 1 in theaters like 2 or 3 times. And I've probably seen it like probably at least a dozen times since on home video. There was a period after Avatar came out on DVD that I was watching it every day. So I'd say it's probably closer to 20, maybe even more. But conservatively, a dozen times. I really like that movie, and I'm looking forward to more of it. I want all of the, I just want new IP. I just want new intellectual properties that tickle my science fiction funny bone.
After Star Wars ends forever, because it's going to end forever, and there's never going to be another Star Wars movie. After that happens in December, the only franchise that I really want more out of is Alien. Mm-hmm. And after that, and aside from that, all I want are more like Annihilation, Ex Machinas. Like, I know they're the same director, but like, I just want more, mm-hmm. more original sci-fi concepts, I guess. I would like, okay. you know, drama to come to be like, well, I guess I just, well, because drama is kind of always
there. Do you want like thoughtful sci-fi? Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, I would like some more thoughtful original sci-fi. Like, I thought Annihilation was just such a refreshing trip to the cinema. Like it wasn't like, the only time I go to the movies is for a Marvel movie, and that's so upsetting. You know, like if MoviePass was still a thing, is it still a thing? I thought it was not, but like, yeah, it's easy with MoviePass to go to the movies every day if you have that kind of time. But for me, it's like. Like, Arrival was such a great trip to the movie theater. Because, yes. like, it was a movie that I heard about, and I told Aaron about it, and I was like, okay, I guess I'll go see this. And the same with Annihilation. I was like, we should go see this movie. It looks like something that's up our alley. And just, like, seeing good, thoughtful, evocative, just passionate sci-fi, you know, it was just good. And, like, it was just better than going to the theater to see Fast and the Furious, which is not bad. I think everyone should go see Fast and the Furious in theaters when it comes out. It's like, you know, the Ben-Hur of this day and age. You know, it's like, it's what we should, as a culture, be going to the movies for. But we should also be able to get good sci-fi and, like, thoughtful films as well. And
yeah, I agree.
I wish that more people would want to go see those movies in theaters, too.
Yeah. Did you check out Prospect?
I guess it has to start with me, though. Prospect?
Yeah.
No.
It's a science fiction movie. It had Pedro Pascal. Came out in 2018, I think. It's a dust film. I don't know if you follow like Dust on YouTube. They have like really great science fiction shorts, but some of the ideas get expanded into features, and this is one of them. It was kind of a cool.
Was it a Netflix one?
No, I don't think so. I don't know who currently has it for distribution.
I definitely saw the trailer. Yeah,
Jay Duplass was in it for. He was like he was one of the lead actors in it, which was kind of cool. But then I had this newcomer Sophie Thatcher, who's really good, and then Pedro Pascal, mm-hmm. of course, who's going to be the Mandalorian. It's a cool science fiction feature. I wouldn't say it's like the most thoughtful, but it's if you enjoy the Last of Us brand of like fiction, this takes place in outer space, so it's kind of like that. And then there's a movie called High Life, which is coming out. I think you can probably see in theaters now. That is supposedly a really interesting, thoughtful take on science fiction that I'm really looking forward to watching. I might watch that while I'm on my break, actually. That's something I've been looking forward to.
I usually just look to see what Denis Villeneuve, how do you say his name?
I don't know.
The guy who did Arrival.
You say it differently every time, and I'm never going to try it.
Denis Villeneuve. I don't know how to say it. Villeneuve. But I just look to see what he's doing pretty typically. Like if I want good sci-fi, I saw this trailer for High Life. I saw this like six months ago, I feel like. And, it looks fascinating and I can't wait for it.
Yeah. But he's just working on Dune, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's just being handed the most amazing intellectual properties to deal with, like Blade Runner, Dune, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sicario. No, he's done with Sicario, right?
He didn't do the last one, right?
The Dia del Soldado. It was the posters for that movie were so funny because I remember somebody had a great Twitter comment being like, why do all these posters for Sicario 2 just look like the banner images on every fucking MAGA right wing nut on Twitter? Why is it just their banner image? Like, Because it was like a skeleton with like a bandana and like two handguns just like crossed across their chest. It was like, this is the stupidest image for a movie ever.
Yeah.
It's like they knew exactly who their audience ended up being. It's like not who Dennis Mann like wanted, but it's who it became.
Denny V. Let's just call him Denny V.
Denny? Yeah, sure. Denny V.
Denny V. But yeah, man, he's had such good movies. I loved Prisoners a lot.
Yeah, that's fantastic as well.
Yeah, that's good stuff. All right. Well, I don't know what I'm going to do over break, and I don't know what we're going to do coming up. We've got to get ahead with some podcast recordings, man. At least get one or two in the bank, because you and I, we're going to be traveling. We're going to be busy.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe the first ever live.
Yeah, I'm hoping.
Or the first ever in-person podcast / Bantha Fodder recording.
Yeah. We could figure out something for Bantha Fodder too. I hadn't really considered that, but podcast would be cool. We got to figure out the schedule. I'm going to buy my flights this week. So,
yeah, same.
I got to figure out when our Airbnb for Breaker gets booked, and then I'll fly in for that. And then hang out. I think I should be able to stay an extra day or two after the big Apple conference, which I'm there for.
Mm-hmm.
And can do some hangs. So think about things that you'd want to do. Like, we could do the touristy things together. I know that you're going to be living out there, but we can do like the touristy stuff while I'm there, because it'll make sense.
Yeah, I mean, I got to figure out the lay of the land first. I have no idea what my life is going to be like when I'm out there.
Oh, for sure. And I know that like I'm coming like probably during the most hectic and discombobulating week for you. But I just kind of had the schedule worked out.
It's like, what is my work schedule? What is my work?
Right.
I'll be in a foreign land.
Yeah. But at least on the weekend, like, you'll have a chance to, we can go explore together at the very least. Like, you won't be alone. Maybe you'll meet somebody and we can go find some cool stuff with,
maybe I'll have a friend is what you're saying.
Yeah. Maybe I'm sure you'll make a friend at work. Maybe somebody will volunteer to show you the ropes and the cool places, which will be cool for you, 'cause you're going to be living there, and also cool for me because I'm just a visitor, but I'll be able to find out what like the actually cool places are in the area.
Yeah.
So
I think the second weekend I might be going to San Diego.
Oh, cool.
Aaron has a conference for work in San Diego, so I was going to fly out and possibly hang out with her for the weekend in the West Coast.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The southern of the West Coast, south of the West Coast.
So the San Diego Zoo just hatched some baby penguins.
Oh, wow. I love those. Penguins rule.
Go see some toddler penguins.